Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about better understanding ourselves and better understanding others. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. On this episode, I talk to Brian Dunning, who you might call a professional skeptic. His work examines beliefs in pseudoscience and conspiracy theories, and just bad perceptions of things in general, and promotes critical thinking and skepticism. He's the creator of the podcast Skeptoid, which has been running for a long time, since 2006. You can find that at skeptoid.com. He's also the author of several books and the creator of several documentaries. I'd heard of the Skeptoid podcast in the past, but I'd never listened to it. Recently, I stumbled across an episode he did about the Aaron Brockovich case, and how the true story there was very different than what was depicted in the movie and what most people perceive about the case. This actually had a connection to the depolarization book that I'm working on, as I was writing a section about conspiracies and bad actions by corporations and governments, and about how often our perceptions of these kinds of things are far more dramatic and exciting than the reality of them. Anyway, once I heard Brian's podcast on the Aaron Brockovich topic, I started looking at more of his work, and I wanted to talk to him about human gullibility. Why do we so easily believe things, even quite outlandish things? I thought with his long history of analyzing all sorts of pseudoscience and magical thinking and conspiracy theories, he'd have some interesting takes. I also wanted to ask him about various things I've been curious about over the years, like what's the deal with chiropractic work? What's the deal with acupuncture? What's the deal with eye movement desensitization therapy? What's he think about the recent UFO stuff? Are there things he used to think were bullshit but now has more respect for? Just a heads up before we start, this podcast has some ads. If you want to subscribe and get an ad-free version of this podcast, and get a few other features like collaborating on upcoming episodes, getting a free copy of my depolarization book, and more, you can learn more about that by going to behavior-podcast.com. Aside from any benefits, you'll be supporting me in making this podcast better and in promoting it. So if you've thought my work on this podcast has been interesting or important, and you've enjoyed all the free content I've put out, maybe you consider signing up. Also, I should say before we start, there were some small audio problems, so if you hear some cutouts, that's why. Okay, here's the talk with Brian Dunning. Hey, Brian, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So maybe we can start with what piqued your interest in focusing on debunking pseudoscience and misinformation?
Well, first of all, I would say debunking is the last thing I try to do. I try hard not to do that. But I would give you the same answer as probably most of my colleagues in science writing is that we just all grew up reading books of strange things, Bigfoot, UFOs, ghosts, whatever it was, watching all the creepy TV shows and just being really interested in weird stuff and wanting to learn what's going on with these stories. And you quickly find out that none of these TV shows or books ever do tell you what's actually going on. They just expect you to accept the sort of the paranormal version of events. And I always wanted more than that. And so I started just having a lot of fun by digging in and going back to the original historical documents. And as a bonus, I get to solve all these mysteries that puzzled me as a kid. It's a lot of fun. It's very fulfilling.
So maybe you could explain a little bit about what you mean that you don't focus on debunking. You don't call what you do debunking.
Yeah, there's really nothing at all to be gained in just saying, "Oh, that's not true," and leaving it at that. That's just negative, and you don't get to take anything away from that. So when I look at a story to find the true history or the true science behind what was actually going on, you're adding a lot to the story. You're not taking anything away. People still have the popular paranormal version, and now they can also enjoy the true version of what's really going on, if that's of interest. I like to make sure that I'm doing something that's inherently positive and constructive rather than inherently negative and destructive.
So when it comes to the problem of gullibility of people being too willing to believe things, do you have an opinion on whether that problem has been getting worse, getting better, or basically remaining the same?
Oh, I think it stays the same. That's a human constant. It's always been that way, and it probably always will be that way. Human brains are wired toward anecdotal thinking, and so it's the easiest place to go. It's the first place all of our brains go, and I think that's always going to be the case. It's just hardwired in us.
And sorry, just to make sure, you're saying not only that it's hardwired for humans, but that the rough percentages of people who believe some blatantly untrue things is basically staying the same?
Yeah, and that percentage is 100%. I mean, it's not like I say, it's the first place everyone's brain goes. It's where our brains are hardwired to go. And where we all differ then is that whatever life experiences we have, which we filter that input come into our heads and learn to match it up to things that we know to be real or that we have more experience with. I think everyone has a different life experience that informs those filters and how they work and how well they work and on what kinds of things they work. We all start in the same place, and we all just end up in different places based on who we are.
Do you think, would you say that the internet has affected things? How do you see the internet playing into that problem?
Yeah, that's a rising tide lifts all boats equally. A lot of people say, oh, the internet's made it easier to spread misinformation, but it's also made it easier to spread good information. So I would say that it has not had any impact. You know, we had newspapers 200 years ago, and we had, you know, storytelling 2,000 years ago. Information spreads the way it spreads. I don't think the mechanism really impacts what kind of information is going to be spread the most.
If you were to ask me to name humanity's biggest problem, I'd say it's our discomfort with uncertainty, because uncertainty seems to make us quite nervous in a existential way. So we always seem to be looking for things that we can be certain about to shore up our sense of meaning and to ward off anxiety and feel like we've got a handle on this world. And I'm curious if how you see that, and do you see that as playing a role in us being often gullible people?
Yeah, I would say that's one way to phrase the root cause. It's often pointed out that conspiratorial thinking is something that's hardwired, because, you know, the classic example is cavemen on the savannah, and they hear a rustling in the grass. But it's the ones who say, oh, that's probably something dangerous, compared to the ones who say, oh, that's nothing, I'm going to ignore it. It's the ones who suspect something harmful and go climb a tree who are incrementally less often eaten by the saber-toothed cats. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot that I just said that's scientifically wrong in that, but nevertheless, that's the idea. A certain amount of paranoia is an evolved trait.
Because it keeps you safe.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes it's going to be right, and sometimes it's going to be wrong. But if you suspect that nothing is harmful, then that's not a very safe position to be in. Just as if you say everything is harmful, means you're going to spend all your time hiding up in that tree, and you're not going to be able to collect enough food. So, you know, there's always the middle ground, and everyone is somewhere on that spectrum.
Another aspect that strikes me in this area is that it can just feel good and exciting to feel like we've stumbled across some secret information, to feel like we're in the know about something, part of an elite group. And yeah, I'm curious if you have thoughts on that. Do you see that playing a big role in various beliefs and things?
For sure. Yeah. I've talked on that subject quite extensively. There's a lot that's appealing about believing that you're part of the elite group that has the secret knowledge. And that's one thing that's attractive at a conscious level to the conspiracy theory crowd. You know, on the one hand, we all have sort of the native instinct to be a little bit paranoid, but it's the people who try to solve that problem by seeking out the elite secret knowledge that they think is going to protect them, make them part of the few rather than part of the many, not one of the sheeple, but one of the people at the top of the pyramid. That's a very attractive idea at a deeply organic level.
Another factor that has struck me about our willingness to believe in various ideas is just the strangeness of life and how we can rationally perceive our existence as strange and mysterious. And I think that can lend itself to a proclivity to believe bullshit or pseudoscience, because we can think things like, well, the world and my existence seems so strange and unlikely. So who's to say this other weird, inexplicable thing couldn't be true? And one way I've seen that play out is, you know, just one of many examples is, you know, talking to somebody who believes something I think is bullshit. And they'll say something like, hey, quantum physics shows us things are strange. So you never really know. It could be true, you know. So I'm curious if you what your thoughts are on that and the perception of life's strangeness.
The perception of life's strangeness. That's I gotta say that's an avenue I've never really gone down before. What's another example of that you see?
Well, you've probably seen the I think you mentioned this in your critical thinking video in some context, the reference to, you know, quantum physics and other experiments showing, you know, that the world isn't doesn't abide by the common sense ways we think the world abides by, which can be a way to both promote bullshit, but also kind of an excuse to believe in bullshit. It's like, hey, this thing is wacky, so therefore I'll believe in this other wacky thing.
Yeah, very much. This is strange, therefore strange things are the norm, therefore I can pretty much believe anything I want, and you can't disprove it because there's other things that are strange that you do acknowledge.
Right, exactly.
It's just not very good. It's just not very good logic.
Right,
That's bad logic.
With the internet, with the rising of all boats, as you put it, it seems like one factor there with the internet playing a role, or just, you know, being present, is that we can easily find evidence for things we want to believe. You know, it's so easy to go online and find someone talking about an idea, no matter what it is, in a way that doesn't seem to have existed pre-internet. Like, you can find a room full of people online professing a belief in something that would have been much harder pre-internet. You would have had to hunt down all these people that believe this thing, you know, if that makes sense. I'm curious if you see, you know, I know you said it probably balances out with the ability to debunk and educate, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, one thing that continually surprises me is when if I'm investigating some, I don't know, any random belief or paranormal story or anything really. And if you go back to the really old literature, and now of course we're able to search really old literature, which we weren't before, you see that there's really nothing new. There is nothing so crazy today that you won't find an analog from 150 years ago. It continually surprises me. And our ability to search old books has really highlighted that for me. There are books written 200 years ago that you would read, and except for the language was fairly different, but the content, you might think it was written yesterday. You know, one example that I always come back to was, when I first started the podcast, The Secret was really big. The book and movie by Rhonda Byrne, The Secret.
Right.
Well, that was nothing new at all. That was word for word rehashed from what was called the New Thought Movement 100 years ago. And that goes back to mysticism from 100 years before that. And I'm sure it goes back 1,000 years. It's just these concepts are just so timeless. But most people don't know that. So you can bring it up and
rehash
people think
them,
people think you're inventing something new and marvelous. It's really quite extraordinary.
The secret thing, it's really interesting. I actually worked on I have a video film degree, so I actually worked on a knockoff cheaper version of The Secret called The Answer to Absolutely Everything.
Oh.
The whole concept of basically like the magical thinking of like we can influence the world with our thoughts, you know, it makes sense that would have a long history because that's kind of like the basic magical thinking wish, you know, we can affect the world just by thinking about it.
Yeah. Nothing new to see here.
Yeah. It seems like, I mean, to your point about making the point that maybe the internet digital age is kind of a wash in those terms, it kind of makes sense because a lot of this stuff just can come down to, you know, what do we want to believe and how much of, you know, the desires we have, you know, like we want to influence the world with our thoughts or these other things, or maybe just influenced by our kind of like us versus them polarization tendencies to be like, oh, I dislike the other group, so I want to believe this conspiracy theory that, you know, maligns them or puts them as the enemy, you know, these kind of things. So I can see your point where you see it as kind of a wash altogether. Yeah. A small note here. Personally, I believe the internet is an amplifier of us versus them polarization. And I think by it amplifying us versus them feelings, it creates more of a demand for various forms of bad thinking. For example, it can make us more likely to be drawn to conspiracy theories and other types of paranoid thinking about the people on the, quote, other side. If you'd like to hear more about that idea, check out a past talk I had with researcher Emily Cuban about the impacts of the internet and social media on polarization. Okay, back to the talk. Yeah, so I just wanted to go through a few random topics because I'm, you know, as you're somebody who's worked in pseudoscience and such for so long, I'd love to get your takes on just a few things that I've been curious about over the years that's been kind of hard for me to get some smart critical thinking people's thoughts on. So if you don't mind, I'll go through some of those now.
Yeah, let's do random ideas. I love that.
Okay. So one of them was chiropractic work. And I've researched this a bit. I've seen how much pseudoscience originated with it and how much even now pseudoscience is there. But then I'm also confused because I do see some smart people sometimes saying they go to chiropractors. So I'm curious, what is your take on the whole chiropractic field, if you had to sum it up?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say there. The chiropractic industry has unfortunately been very successful at inserting themselves into the public perception of medicine. You know, they don't go to medical schools. Their schools are not certified. They're not, it's not a medical specialty under the American Medical Association. Their schools are not accredited by the Department of Education. And so calling yourself a doctor as a chiropractor should be legally meaningless, but they've been very successful in getting states, I'm U.S. centric now, but it's probably something similar in most other countries, to allow them to use the word doctor in business. Naturopaths are the same way in many states now. If you're someone who grows pot, you can't literally legally call yourself, you know, doctor, whoever, because you're an herbalist. That's a deceptive trade practice. But chiropractors have gotten around that, and they've been able to get recognized by the states. You know, that's not a scientific thing. That's a legal thing. That's a bureaucracy thing. So that they can call themselves doctor by no means indicates that what they're doing is scientific. A lot of people report relief from going to chiropractors, and the main reason for that is that what they're doing incorporates legitimate aspects of massage and physical therapy. The difference is they're not providing it legally because you have to be a physical therapist to provide physical therapy. You have to be certified in massage to give a massage legally, except certain kinds of massages, but we're not talking about those. There's some legitimacy toward what the better chiropractors are doing. The thing is, they're just wrong about the mechanism. It's got nothing to do with, you know, popping the little bubbles of synovial fluid and making the cracking sounds. It's basically stretching and massaging the muscles around it. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. So I would say just go to a physical therapist, go to a DPT, a CPT, someone who is trained to do that legally. And one thing that you'll see that really supports what I'm saying is that many chiropractors of some sort of a certified physical therapist on staff. Unfortunately, many of them do this so that they can bill against that person's insurance and accept insurance for providing chiropractic services. So that's something that FDA and the FTC has not been very successful at dealing with. I think it's just too enormous a problem in its scope to ever be possible to deal with these people one by one. But I mean, the fact is, chiropractic, for everything that differentiates chiropractic from physical therapy, is 100% bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no, the innate intelligence, which is their word for chi, the energy that they believe flows through your body and is hampered by these blockages in the spine that they say they're fixing by basically doing a knuckle crack on your spine. Mm. That's just straight up false pseudoscience. There is no such thing as a mystical energy field flowing through your body that is the root cause of all disease. When you see chiropractors with all kinds of things, illnesses, some treat cancer, some treat all kinds of childhood diseases when there's no conceivable plausibility behind that. So it's there's a small segment of the chiropractic, it's probably a larger than 50% segment of chiropractic that does provide useful care, but what they're providing, they're not licensed to provide. And you can go to a licensed provider legally. So I see no reason to go to a chiropractor.
What are your thoughts on acupuncture? And acupuncture, obviously, you know, we hear a lot about how it seems to work and insurance covers it and such. But obviously it's hard to imagine. We don't know how it works. So I'm curious to get your take on that.
Well, I mean, the science is pretty solid on that. There's been a lot of randomized controlled trials on acupuncture, and it fails completely every time.
Oh, okay.
People don't know whether they're, you know, you can do the sham acupuncture with these little sleeves where it just pricks the skin or makes, you can't tell if the needle actually went into you or not. And so doing these tests, it turns out that there's no difference in the relief that people report. It doesn't matter where you put the needles. Really nothing. It doesn't matter even if the needles go in. And we can learn all of this through testing, which has been done. Mm. So when you look at the scientific literature, it's clear that acupuncture does not work. Now, does that mean that people don't get any relief from it? Well, no, they do, because it's a very powerful placebo. Actually sticking a needle in someone is a pretty dramatic intervention. And so it's going to have as strong a placebo effect as anything. What's important to know, though, is it doesn't matter if you're actually putting the needle in or where you put the needle in. This is just people's brains saying, hey, something dramatic is happening to me right now, so I'm going to feel relief from my pain or my fatigue or nausea or whatever it is that you're taking it for. So it's interesting. It's a great case study in how and why placebos work, and it's the best example. But I certainly wouldn't use it if you're trying to actually solve something.
Yeah, the placebo effect, I mean, that probably accounts for so much of, you know, including some of the chiropractic work, I'd imagine, especially on the more pseudoscience-y and spiritual side of the chiropractic work. And I could see that playing a role in so much of the, probably a good amount of the things you've talked about in your podcast and such.
Yeah, that's acupuncture is definitely one of the standards in the field of science versus pseudoscience.
Why do you think, is it still true that some insurances will pay for acupuncture? Do you know much about that?
Sure. Yeah. You got to keep in mind that these are bureaucratic decisions. These are not science decisions. Mm-hmm. And if there is sufficient consumer demand, then insurance companies will sell that product. It's not a science question. It's purely a legal and bureaucracy question.
Do you think theoretically, even if they knew it was a placebo effect, do you think insurance companies have a motivation to cover things even if they know that, hey, it's working, but it's working through the placebo effect?
Well, I don't want to get too far into how insurance law works, because that is not an area of expertise of mine.
Right.
So I wouldn't want to speak out of place. But I mean, I can tell you the general overview, but getting into the nitty-gritty beyond that would be above my pay grade.
I understand. Speaking of placebo, this is probably a similar question. I don't know if you've researched eye movement therapy, which I sometimes hear about, and it strikes me as one of these similar things where basically eye movement therapy is for people listening, is they do this thing where they have you revisit painful memories and traumas, and they do this thing where they have you move your eyes in a certain way while you do that. And people have reported that it's helpful, but in my opinion, from what I know of it, it's similar to a lot of things where, you know, just the fact that you're working on trying to help yourself mentally and get over something traumatic, it is in itself helpful no matter what that is. So I think that, to me, that helps account for why some of that and some other things in that area, similar kind of psychological treatments, would have an effect just by the mere fact of you trying to, you know, do something about your trauma and your pain.
Yeah, what you're talking about is called EMDR.
Yeah.
And I had exactly the same reaction as you did when I first heard about it. I mean, my default was, oh, that sounds like nonsense. But It just so happens my wife is a mental health therapist, and we were married while she was going all through school and everything. And when they did their unit on EMDR, you know, it's something that they all did to each other. And no, it is a very real thing. I don't know if there's anything special about the eyes, or if you could be just as easily doing something with your hands or your toes or jumping up and down, but the EMDR gets you to consciously focus on one thing, which makes it easier for you to deal with the traumatic memory. I remember she talked about one particular case study in her class as the professor was doing EMDR on this person. This was a young woman who had witnessed something extremely, extremely horrible. You don't need the details, but it was an infant being killed in a very violent and graphic manner. And this poor woman was just tormented by this memory. And using EMDR was the only time she was able to talk about it and describe what happened. And you do that with enough repetition, and then finally you're able to just deal with it. And then it becomes something that you can talk about normally without having to do the EMDR. They're doing the same thing is it LSD now? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where this is in being approved, but they're giving people LSD. You know, small doses of LSD. I think it's LSD. It could be ecstasy. I don't know.
Mushrooms maybe too, yeah. A small note here. I realized I think we're talking about ecstasy here, also known as MDMA. There is research that's been done involving taking MDMA while revisiting past traumas. They're doing research with hallucinogenics and ketamine and such on anxiety and depression, but I'm not sure that involves revisiting past traumas and such. But I confess I don't know much about all that. Back to the talk.
But it puts them in a state where they're able to talk about these things, and you're able to do the repetition and talk about it and get it out. And it gets to the point where it's no longer a traumatic memory for you to retrieve and discuss. So yeah, it's a very powerful tool, which came as a surprise to me.
Yeah. I'd like to read up on that more, because I'd imagine, I mean, my own theory would be that just by revisiting it, you're helping yourself. And I'd be curious if anyone's done studies of, you know, doing another body part or doing anything and doing the same thing and seeing the effect. But yeah, that's interesting to know that you've got some respect for it, and there's good writings about it and such.
I don't think I've done an episode of my show on that, but it's one of those things where, you know, I love it when my default assumption about what the conclusion is probably going to be, I love it when that turns out to be completely wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's one case.
And I'm curious, maybe this is a good segue. Are there things that you used to think were pseudoscience, or initially thought were pseudoscience or bullshit, and then later you gained more respect for them? Or are there instances of that come to mind?
Well, this is the most common question I get. Mm. And it's usually asked by someone. What they're really meaning to ask is, what are the cases where the paranormal explanation has turned out to be the true one? Mm. And I honestly have to say, no, we have not found any of those yet. So I have not yet found any case where it turns out that magic is real or anything like that. The closest I can get to is what used to be considered a conspiracy theory called numbers stations, which are these shortwave radio stations. They're not as common as they were even just 15, 20 years ago. But they are radio stations that you tune in a shortwave receiver, which is harder and harder to find these days. And at a certain time of day and a certain day of the week, you will get a radio broadcast that is an automated voice repeating strings of numbers, five at a time, and they repeat. And this might go on for 5 minutes. It might go on for an hour. And the belief was, the claim online was that, oh, number stations, this is, you know, world governments doing something nefarious. It's sending instructions to their spies or whatever it is. And then people who are of the more skeptical mindset were saying things. It's probably something mundane like oceanographic research buoys transmitting data or something like anything that doesn't require some nefarious purpose. Mm-hmm. And then what happened on September 11th, 2001, many people recognize that date because something big happened on that date. But there's something else happened on page two of the newspaper, which nobody ever turned to page two of the newspaper. No one else knows what else happened on that day. But inside the Pentagon, while part of it was burning from getting hit by the plane, they made a large arrest of a number of people including a fairly highly placed intelligence official. And what these people had been doing was tuning into this number station broadcast out of Cuba, typing the numbers into a laptop computer and decrypting them. And they were, in fact, instructions from Cuban intelligence, communications going back and forth between Cuban intelligence and Cuban spies placed inside the Pentagon.
Whoa.
And since then, there have been quite a few other arrests all around the world by other countries. The evidence always turning out to be laptop computers with these decryption programs on them and people having been found to be listening to number stations.
Hmm.
So it turns out that the tinfoil hat explanation, if you were, was the true one.
I had not heard that. That's very interesting. Are there any other things that come to mind in that area as far as conspiracy theories or pseudoscience?
Not really. That's usually my go-to answer for that question. There just haven't been that many other cases where it's not easy enough.
You're surprised?
Yeah. I mean, I want to find more because that's always the most exciting kind.
The truth is out there, but it's much less exciting than people think sometimes.
That's right.
So I got to ask you about the UFOs, of course. What is your take on those? And I just happened to see you were putting out a movie about that, I think.
Yeah, I'm producing a movie on that right now. That's something we do at Skeptoid, was we always have a documentary film in the works. Mine is called The UFO Movie They Don't Want You to See, which was initially just a fake title just for fun. But then it turned out that was the title that workshopped the best. And so I decided to keep it.
I mean, that gets attention. I mean, yeah,
it does.
Good clickbait.
It's got that going for it.
Yeah. Are you willing to say what your take is on it? Do we have to wait for the movie?
Well, no, I have nothing particularly earth shattering to say on that subject. We think that there are probably lots of life out there in the universe. And it's clear that if there is, it can't get here and we can't get there. And there's a lot of reasons for that. So if you're going to make the claim that some UFO is probably an alien spaceship, well, you have to have pretty damn good evidence. And if you're going to believe such a claim, you have to have a very high bar for the standard of evidence that you're going to accept. So that's mostly what the film focuses on. We do talk about a number of cases in particular and show why these popular cases that are promoted on the TV shows are actually terrible, terrible evidence, and why we need to have better evidence, and what some of that good evidence might be. And finally, how we probably will meet neighbors in the galaxy one day. And I do think we probably will, but I'd give that it's not a definitely, and it's going to be a long time, but I think it'll happen.
So you sound pretty skeptical on that. And as somebody who's watched, you know, for example, the 60 Minutes episode, which, you know, paints a pretty compelling picture that something strange was going on. Do you think something strange was going on that maybe might not be aliens, or do you think it just wasn't that strange to begin with? Or
which case are you talking about?
So there was the videos of the aircraft that were caught on the Navy videos, and also the eyewitness of the people who said that they were, you know, flying around the Pacific and they would see like UFO aircraft almost every day out there, and that those are the people that talked on 60 Minutes about it, the two Air Force people.
Just a correction here, I meant to say the Atlantic Ocean, not the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember the science writing community just erupting in horror over that CNN was incredibly credulous and just gave essentially an unchallenged platform to...
Oh, you mean the 60 Minutes episode?
Yeah. 60 Minutes, yeah. Basically gave an unchallenged platform to the advocates for alien visitation. So yeah, there's nothing at all interesting in those Navy videos. There's very widely available explanations of what you're actually seeing and what's actually going on in those, but nobody ever gives those any attention because they're not headlines. And we do talk about that in my film also. We do go through all the Navy videos, four of them actually, and show exactly what you're really seeing and how we know that. Yeah, I mean, Navy pilots are... There's a perception that pilots are incapable of error. Anything a pilot says or reports must be a literal true account. And that's really hard to defend. That's not a very sound viewpoint. Because you can ask any pilot, are pilots always inerrant and incapable of making mistakes? And they will say, no, we're as human as anyone else, and we make mistakes every day, just like every people, person does. You know, you've got cases of Navy pilots landing at the wrong airport. Right. I mean, they can certainly be mistaken about things that have nothing to do with their training or any particular skills they might have or the knowledge of the systems of their aircraft.
Yeah, I guess that one really stood out, I guess, because it was two people from, you know, doing the same missions who were willing to say they saw them multiple times. But it's interesting to get your take. I was curious how skeptical you were.
The star of those shows is Mylar balloons from cruise ships.
Mm.
Cruise ships leave a trail of Mylar balloons wherever they go. They're metallic, and they do have radar signatures. So you're going to see them on the radar. You're going to see them as you fly past them with the parallax effect. That's the parallax effect is basically the main culprit behind most of those Navy UFO videos, where it looks like something is moving, but really you're the one who's moving because you're in a fast-moving aircraft.
Mm.
And when you break down the numbers that's displayed on the screens, and you can see what's the altitude, how far away you are, and it's just kind of a great aha moment in each of these videos when you realize what you're actually seeing. And that goes back to what I'm talking about, where you know the process is to learn something new. It's not just to simply say, oh, that's fake. I don't think that's a spaceship. La-di-da. Leave it at that.
Mm. So I'd imagine you probably believe then that in the cases where multiple people report seeing a UFO or anything really, I'd imagine you would say there's some elements of kind of like mass delusion or a light version of it where they start talking about it and they convince themselves that it happened. Is that accurate?
That's something I'd have to address on a case by case basis. Mm. I mean, I've dealt with a lot of cases where there actually were a lot of people witnessing something, and I've dealt with a lot of cases where it turns out that very few people actually witnessed something, but the story got changed dramatically in the retellings and retellings and retellings over the decades. So you've got all cases. There's the famous case out of South Africa, for example, where a handful of children said they saw something. More than 250 who were present at the same place said that there was nothing there at all. But then they were all put into groups to tell the story of what they saw. And so all their stories conformed and merged together because this was handled by UFO authors and not by, like, you know, police investigators who would know that the first thing you do with witnesses is you just separate them,
right,
and you interrogate them separately to find out where the stories might match up and where they don't. Well, of course, the UFO authors are very much motivated to do the exact opposite of that. They want all the kids to have the same story. And they were successful in getting about a fifth of the kids to some version of events that was, you know, a lot different in how it was finally published than compared to what the kids said on the first few days. These cases are fascinating to learn from. Why did the story change so much? How did it change? How do we prevent this from happening again in the future?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is to not have UFO authors involved in the investigation.
Right. It really, really pays to be skeptical and to realize how fallible we are. And yeah, that's the whole social aspect of, you know, telling a story makes us more likely to believe a story and all these kinds of things. Yeah. And maybe a good place to end on, would you like to share about what you're working on these days?
Yeah, well, of course, my main podcast, Skeptoid, is what I'm best known for. That's at skeptoid.com. And the UFO movie I'm working on is at theufo.movie. There's little clips from it and everything that's on that website. I didn't even know .movie was a website, but it is, theufo.movie. Check that out.
Nice URL. Yeah.
I know.
Looking forward to that.
It's really good. I'm super stoked with it.
Yeah, looking forward to watching that. Okay, thanks a lot, Brian. This has been great, and thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun for me too.
That was Brian Dunning, creator of the Skeptoid podcast and assorted other books and videos and projects aimed at promoting skepticism and critical thinking. His site is at skeptoid.com. If you enjoyed this episode, there are some related episodes of mine in the library that you might enjoy. I have an episode where I talk to a physicist about free will and what it's like to live life without believing in free will. You might say that not believing in free will is maybe the ultimate skepticism one can have about the world, so I saw that as a bit related. I have an episode where I talk to Kirk Schneider, an existential psychologist and therapist. One thing we talk about is the strangeness of life and its connection to existentialist thought. I also have a piece I wrote about the strangeness of life, which you can find by searching for Zach Elwood, Strangeness of Life. That's on medium.com. I have an episode where I talk to Stephen Heine about our desire for meaning and how when we lose meaning in one area, we can feel the pressure to defend meaning or create meaning in other areas. This is related to the idea that our belief in strange, unlikely things can sometimes be a way for us to give ourselves meaning. In general, I think a lot of my work on polarization is about being skeptical of narratives about the other political group that may be common in our political group. I think embracing humility and skepticism about the various narratives floating around us is an important part of combating us versus them polarization. To get links to some of the resources mentioned in this talk, or related to this talk, go to the post for this episode on my site, behavior-podcast.com. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.